Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm John Lovett.
I'm Tommy Vitor. We're not used to this order.
John Favreau is taking some much-needed R&R on Joe Manchin's houseboat. Joining us, we have a special guest. He is a correspondent for NPR and host of It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders. Sam Sanders, good to have you on the pod.
It's so good to be here. I'm realizing now that I have really big shoes to fill, so I hope I don't screw it up.
Well, here's something I don't get to do in my gay voice very often. Happy Pride.
Happy Pride. What a pride it's been.
What a pride it's been. On today's show, thanks for being here, Sam.
Of course.
On today's show, as Trump holds his first rally since leaving office to lie about the election, and Democrats look for a way to investigate January 6th after Republicans blocked a bipartisan commission, we have three big stories that look at how Trump's rejection of the results led to the attack on the Capitol, how the Department of Justice responded, and what was taking place inside the White House as protests turned violent. Also today, conservatives attack the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the military generally for suggesting it's good when students read books. We'll briefly talk about the latest on infrastructure and how President Biden saying something obvious and true about the negotiations caused a mini freakout over the weekend, and Tucker Carlson gets outed as a secret source for the reporters he claims to despise.
That pause was nice. Really nice pause.
Before we get to the show, we did record our first Love It or Leave It live in over a year to raise money for the Trans Justice Funding Project. We raised over $50,000, and it's one of my favorite episodes of all time with an incredible lineup of guests. So check it out. You can listen to it as a podcast, you can watch it on YouTube, or you can donate at crooked.com/pridefund. Okay, so since Friday, we've had these three big stories. I'd say that two are pretty serious, and one is pure gossip, which is at times single source to some of the biggest liars on earth. But the details are fun, and we've earned it. So let's start with a story that takes place in the run-up to the insurrection. Jonathan Carl, a reporter for ABC, interviewed former Attorney General Bill Barr, who's obviously most famous for lying about the Mueller report, protecting Trump at all costs. It's December. You have Trump running around claiming the election is stolen, but at the same time, Republicans are desperate to hold on to two Senate seats in Georgia. And Carl documents surprising conversations between Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Majority Leader at the time, and Attorney General Bill Barr. Tommy, can you talk a little bit about what McConnell and Barr were scheming over? And were you surprised by how direct the talks between them turned out to be?
Yes, I was quite surprised. I mean, look, there's sort of two big takeaways from this story for me. One, you know, Barr repeated in stronger terms, more colorful terms, what we already knew, which is that he didn't see any evidence of election fraud. He said, quote, it was all bullshit. And then two, you have this anecdote where Mitch McConnell, calls Bill Barr, the sitting attorney general at the time, and asks him to talk to Trump, to intervene with him, to shut down these lies about electoral fraud, because McConnell was worried that Trump's ranting and raving about the election would impact the Georgia Senate runoffs. Now, that shocked me, that someone, the Senate Majority Leader, would call the sitting attorney general to ask him to intervene politically in Senate races. But like you sort of alluded to, John, I mean, McConnell confirmed this with Jonathan Carl, and Bill Barr said a lot of it on the record, so they don't seem too worried about it. A lot of the same people who are quite concerned about Bill Clinton talking to Loretta Lynch back in the day on the tarmac about an investigation are seemingly cool with this. That surprised me.
Yeah, you know, it's said, like, even, you know, Jonathan Carl is very forthright at the top. Like, this is a bunch of interviews with Bill Barr. It is, Bill Barr is seeking to tell a story about himself, but What Carl says is that Barr seems to be frustrated that he's been widely seen as a Trump lackey who politicized the Justice Department. So let me tell you a story about how I yet again politicized the Justice Department. Sam, what was your reaction to this kind of rehabilitation effort by Bill Barr?
I mean, I've stopped being surprised by it. I think there's a litany of people that have been around Trump's orbit that are trying to guarantee for themselves some semblance of a legacy or their next job. So the fact that these kind of interviews from someone like him exist don't surprise me. What surprises me, and what perhaps is the most dismaying, is that at the same time, Barr is saying to Trump, you can't win this election, it's over, there is no fraud. He also indulged Trump and said, I'll allow the DOJ to keep investigating this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that felt like, you know, a parent when their 5-year-old is like, there's a monster under my bed. there's like two options. You can say there is no monster, go to bed, or you can look under the bed for half an hour and waste everyone's time. And the fact that Barr chose to do that in a way that's much more serious than like what's beneath some child's bed, that's the danger. So I'm not surprised that someone like Barr would do an interview like this. I'm surprised that he was so casually talking out of both sides of his mouth. On the one hand, he could say to Trump, you're going to lose. On the other hand, but we'll investigate. Why not? The why notness of it is very dismaying, if not surprising.
Do you think he looked under the bed and found like a half-eaten McRib? Like, what was under there? What are we talking about?
This is the thing. It's like Trump has been trying to get everyone to look under his bed for like more than 4 years at this point. And the fact, sorry to keep this metaphor going, but it's like,
I love it.
No, it's good.
This has been the central problem of Trump acolytes, you know, the people that who thought that they could do two things at once with him. On the one hand, defend institutions, fight for the truth, but on the other hand, indulge Trump. When you indulge Trump, there's no end to the indulging. He's going to keep it going to the point of literal insurrection. And this is like, this article and this story feels new, but that both sidesism, both sides of the mouthism, that's been a constant since this man was running for office, you know, the first time back in 15 and 16.
Yeah, I mean, you remember the quote by a Republican leader right after the election saying, oh, we'll indulge him for a couple of weeks. What's the worst that can happen?
Yep.
Tommy, so putting aside how political an effort this is, like sort of it's like, okay, we have the majority leader and the attorney general basically worrying over Senate seats in Georgia. You have the president attacking American democracy all over the country. And the only reason the two most powerful Republicans on earth are willing to intervene at all is because they're trying to win the Senate. They're not worried about the democracy. They're not worrying about what it does to the constitutional order. They're worrying about these two Senate seats in Georgia. What does that tell you about what would happen if a Republican nominee were to challenge the results in 2024, say?
Yeah, look, I think it's absolutely like a blinking red warning sign. I mean, I think Sam's sort of point he just made that there's no end to the indulging once you start, I think is sort of the core theme to all the things that happened over the weekend. I mean, I watched the entire Trump rally because I was quite bored. And like the last 30 minutes are about the election lie, right? Like there's no getting endorsed by Trump and getting up on stage and supporting him because you love the tax cuts and because you love that we, you know, got out of the war in Afghanistan or whatever and saying, yeah, but, you know, I don't love this other stuff. I don't love this big lie that he keeps perpetuating. It is the core of who he is right now. And like to be a part of Trumpism, you have to go along with that, right? So he just pulls everyone along with him to the darkest depths, no matter how much they would want to avoid that part of the conversation. Like it's disconcerting for the next iteration of whatever he does politically.
Yeah, and you see it. So the next story, there's this ProPublica story that looks at what happened in the run-up to the protest and rallies that took place on January 5th and January 6th. And you've kind of seen that same dynamic playing out of people around Trump trying to indulge Trump's fantasy around the election, while Trump officials are trying to manage the fact that this has drawn in some of the worst elements in American society. This is the reporting from ProPublica. On one side stood Women for America First, which wanted to, and I want to, this is stated so with such a kind of genteel manner. They wanted to hold a kind of extended oral argument with multiple speakers making their case for how the election had been stolen. Oh, is that what that is? Rejecting the election. And then on the other side was Stop the Steal, a new, more radical group that had recruited avowed racists with Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and Alex Jones and his followers. But it turns out that there was a ton of communication between the Trump White House and the various factions that were putting this on. And while they were trying to manage the optics of who was going to speak and who wasn't going to speak, Trump was promoting all of it. He was promoting Stop the Steal. He was promoting this less radical but still anti-democratic group that was sort of running counter to them. Tommy, one thing that comes out in this story is that the officials around Trump were desperately trying to get Alex Jones and other speakers like that to have a different time slot. Do you think that that counts as disavowing a person who has harassed school shooting victims and has promoted the most racist propaganda that you have disavowed them by saying that they should speak the night before at a different time slot?
Yeah, or have worse seats at the rally. First of all, shout out ProPublica. ProPublica is having a moment. They got this story. They broke the big tax story. They got every rich person's tax return. So credit to them. It's like Britney.
ProPublica is having a moment.
They are the it girl. of journalism right now.
They are the Icarus of journalism. I support ProPublica. I think they're great.
That's so funny.
Yeah, the story was really interesting. Like, it's unclear if the organizers spoke to Mark Meadows, then the chief of staff. It's clear that Trump aides were working behind the scenes to keep these most controversial march leaders off the stage. These the worst actors were this guy, Ali Alexander, Alex Jones, Nick Fuentes, who's just an out-and-out white supremacist. But you also learned a lot about this woman, Caroline Wren, who's an establishment Republican fundraiser. She has close ties to Don Jr. and Kim Guilfoyle. So whatever the White House was doing to try to keep these people off the stage, she was personally pushing to get Ali Alexander and Alex Jones on the stage to get them better seats. She was working with Katrina Pearson. So there is some suggestion that they were trying to manage who spoke at this rally so as not to embarrass Trump. But the outcome eventually was that Trump offered language and rhetoric to this group that was, you know, that did more to incite the crowd than I think anyone else could. So I don't know that they really get their distance here.
Sam, what do you make of this story?
I think if you look at it in the most craven interpretation, for Donald Trump, that rally before the insurrection was not about actually changing the outcome of the election. It was about setting up what would come next for him and his media empire, right? And like how much of getting the Alex Joneses there and the other folks there to gin up these crowds and get all of this time on the airwaves was to promote Trump and what might come next, you know? And I think that like there's two ways to look at what Trump was doing in that moment, either totally trying to undermine democracy and become a dictator, or just being a craven businessman. And I kind of think it's, I want to say like it works if you look at what Donald Trump is as a media business. He is a media business and he needs to keep attention. And once he realized he wasn't going to have the White House, it was like, how can I go out in a way that keeps the attention on me? And so when you look at the folks that were organizing that rally and organizing those events, they had a financial interest in seeing what Trump would do next and helping him do something next, like Parler or his own media business or his own new platform. So it was as much about that as him being mad that he lost. And I think that like, if it's about that and about eyeballs and viewers, of course you're going to have Alex Jones there because he gets eyeballs and he gets ratings. So it's not surprising. And I think that like we have to, as journalists, look at these things for what they are as well. I think that like there's so much coverage of Trump continuing to try to have rallies where there's a little more seriousness ascribed to what he's doing than what it really is. This guy needs eyeballs to make money. He needs eyeballs to make money, right? Yeah. And we should not cover these rallies without keeping that in mind. And I think that just because he gets the old band together and sings the same songs doesn't mean it's going to be a number one hit again. You know, like I would happily go to a Jagged Edge reunion concert. It doesn't mean that Where the Party At is going to be number one on the Billboard charts the next week, you know? And so we have to put what Trump is and what he represents post-White House in perspective and understand that whether he is a politician or in office or not, he is a media entity. He is a media enterprise, and he is going to try to get as much attention as he can until he's out of here.
Bring all the Jagged Edge comparisons to me, please. Last night I watched a Netflix show about pop culture and pop music, and I watched an episode just on Boys to Men that I highly recommend for everyone because they do not get enough credit for how good they were at singing and how they merged Philly and Motown together. Love it. I apologize.
Don't apologize for that.
No, I'm
New Jack Swing forever.
Just processing that information. I think you're right, though. My one caveat on what Sam just said is that I think that one aspect of Trump as a politician is the shock that he experiences by how far his own bullshit has taken him. And so, you know, we're going to talk about this Michael Wolff reporting about just how about Giuliani and Trump spinning each other up, actually coming to believe that Mike Pence really might step in and give him the presidency. And I do think two things can be happening at once because he doesn't need these facts to align. He doesn't need his story to make sense. That's sort of that's the essence of what Trump has done as a politician. He says whatever he has to say, even if it's contradictory to what he had said moments ago. There's no theory.
It's about a feeling. There's no theory. It's just feeling.
It's about a feeling. And so I think that you're right that this was about generating the most attention, generating the most press possible, getting people riled up. But if it did result in those objections working, if it did result in Republicans being so intimidated as to overturn the election on his behalf with Mike Pence at the helm, that would have been a great outcome for him too. And it puts in context too. I think one thing that also I think was, I'm glad we're having this conversation about these look backs, is because it helps make sense of what was happening while these things were unfolding. Like, I remember when Bill Barr comes out there and says that he sees no evidence of widespread fraud. And I'm like, that doesn't seem like the Bill Barr I know. And now we know McConnell was trying to win the Senate with Bill Barr's help. And then it was a little bit strange when Trump was like, we're going to start here and we're going to walk to the Capitol. And then there's a bit of confusion at the time about, wait, there's an event at the Ellipse and there's some smaller events supposedly taking place at the Capitol, but it's one big event. What's going on here? Oh, it just seems clear to me now. Like, oh, I see. They really were trying to have it both ways and keep this whole big operation together with the Proud Boys, but also some of the kind of base of the Republican Party that they've been relying on the whole time.
Well, and like the most revealing part of that reporting from Michael Wolff that y'all sent to me, and it just like stopped me in my tracks. It's like, you know, he's at that rally before the insurrection begins and he's like, we're going to walk over there. And then he walks off stage and his staff is like, what did you mean? And he was like, I didn't mean that. He didn't mean it. You know, he understands that there's a disconnect and a difference between what he says and what he really means. And he's never had to grapple with that. And it's like his most ardent supporters, I don't think, have ever internalized that. Like, he's never going to put himself at risk for them. He's never going to risk it all for them. He's going to preserve himself at all costs. But you feel free to walk to the Capitol and risk your life. You feel free to do it. That, like, to the very end, that was his dynamic.
So, Tommy, let's talk about this. So there's an excerpt of Michael Wolff's book that looks at the day the insurrection was unfolding. We already talked about how Rudy Giuliani, who Wolf reports was drinking heavily.
I didn't know that. That was really surprising to me. I had no idea, but now it makes sense.
It does make sense.
Have you seen drunk people before?
I've seen myself. I've seen drunk people before.
I guess I would say it's the first time I've seen it actually written down, but I do think it was pretty obvious that Rudy was drinking too much when he asked Jeanine Pirro for 3 fingers of scotch on air. shouldn't have done that. So, Tommy, yeah. In this story, well, we can get to some of the more substantive points, but what was Ivanka Trump doing as the protests turned violent
in
the White House?
This was one of my favorite little anecdotes. Apparently, she was, as the Capitol is being overrun, like we're hours into it, she's walking around the West Wing. She's talking to people about how her kids got into some Florida private school. And then she tweeted some message to American patriots. She was urging them to calm down, to stop the violence. And then she ultimately deleted this tweet, but she called them American patriots. But I just love thinking about Ivanka walking around as the Capitol is getting sacked, talking about how her kids just got into some like $50,000 a year preschool because, you know, that's where her head is at all times.
So, Sam, one point that Wolf makes here that I do think is worth highlighting, and he's a sleazy person, and a lot of this has to be taken with a grain of salt.
Big old grain of salt.
And the amount of like single source, like there's a moment in the story where Jason Miller, who is a despicable human being, just a creep beyond all creeps, is like, and then I shot out of bed and I realized we had to have an orderly transition. It's like, all right, now you're so full of shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
But there is one point that he makes that I do want to highlight. He says this, as the effort to stop the certification is unfolding, he says, there is nobody on the White House side whipping votes. There is nobody on the White House side who's particularly up to date on who might be with them or against them, other than from public reports. The extent that, as the media darkly warned, there was an extraordinary plot to hold on to power, an incipient coup even, there really were only two plotters with no one to back them up. So, Sam, on the one hand, that's true. This was an incompetent operation. As you said, it is a media operation. But also, at the same time, even with all that incompetence, most Republicans now believe that the election was stolen and Trump should be the president. How do you think about that balance between the malevolence of what they were trying to achieve and the incompetence with which they tried to achieve it?
I think we should be used to it by now. I think it, like, this was just what it was from the start. And I think the problem really for me in the aftermath of election day was the speed at which mainstream newsrooms, including my own, were eager to put on the air and in the paper and on TV the voices in the Trump White House that said, oh, it's not over yet. You know, I speak for Big J journalism, we could have said, we're not interviewing you. You know this is psych and this is bogus. No. And so it took my industry a good month to start calling the big lie, after we had given those folks the microphone to tell the big lie for a month. So the behavior of the Trump administration is not surprising, as I've said several times this conversation. What is surprising is the extent to which we all just sit there and watch it happen and don't say anything. And the we right now is my industry. You know, there is a version of reality in which a day or two after election night, CNN and the New York Times and NPR and the Post and the Journal put all their heads together and say, we're going on our airwaves and our papers saying it's done. We didn't do that. You know, we all were at that Four Seasons Total Landscaping press conference, right? So some of this, I hate to use the word blood, some of this, whatever it is on our hands too.
These are clear, obvious lies, but there are real world consequences no matter what Bill Barr says, right? Like Trump savaged Bill Barr the minute he made all these statements with ABC this morning. The Michigan Republican-led state Senate concluded that there was no evidence of fraud in the 2020 election. This Arizona audit that's happening as we speak, and not done until August, I believe, is clearly a joke. It's not credible. It's being conducted by unqualified people. But all of this churn, all this big electoral lie content is leading to voter suppression laws in dozens of states that the net effect is going to be probably to make it harder for mostly Black, mostly Latino people to vote in the next election. So, like, there is real damage being done by these lies, even if Bill Barr is belatedly repeating that it was all nonsense.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's the flip side to the coin of the kind of failure to tell the truth as it was unfolding. It's like, okay, there was a failure to be direct enough about what was taking place in this country out of some reverence for dispassionate, non-biased coverage.
No, that or means a desire to hold on to this mythical conservative news consumer. I digress. Go
right.
ahead. Mm-hmm.
Hold, but no. But that's important. That's part of this, right? That's how they have to think about that mythical consumer. And then after the fact, the coup fails, the insurrection attempt fails, and then you have the kind of cynical, hard-edged media reporter like Michael Wolff, like many others, who say, "See, like there's all these sensationalistic resistance-y types who are taking this way too seriously, acting like it was some coup in the making. But look how dumb it all turned out to be. Look how incompetent it all turned out to be." Tommy, do you think we overstated the case for the fact that Trump was a threat to democracy? Do you think we're overstating the case now?
No. I think it's absolutely clear that he is willing to believe his own lies, and he's willing to push people until they go along with them. And that if he had had the opportunity to stay in power, and it sounds like for a while he and Rudy Giuliani were the only ones who actually thought there was a chance Mike Pence might actually take steps to overturn the election, that he would have been happy to remain. So I think we came very close to him sticking around in the most traditionally authoritarian manner possible, and it was a big deal.
You know, it's like Lord of the Flies. The book starts, you're like, these are little boys. They're going to have some fun on this island. And then before you know it, shit turns.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's just human nature. You know, if you push any human hard enough, long enough, something happens, shit turns, and it gets real. And so it's psych, I'm just playing until it's not.
Yep.
And I mean, this is not new to Trump. This is just human nature. And like, Trump is this rare breed of politician who just doesn't have a stop button. He doesn't have a freaking stop button at all.
Yeah,
it's the and you know you can see these connections, right? Like Trump knows the election wasn't stolen. He's basically talked about it. He gives interviews about the different demographics he lost at this point, and yet he still says that there's this big lie, and everybody plays along, and then a bunch of people believe it, and they show up at the Capitol, where you have a clearly blatant effort to invent a boogeyman in critical race theory. But a bunch of people start showing up at school board meetings screaming because they believe it, because they really believe it. They have internalized it, and so the creators of this propaganda may not be great organizers. They may not be successful at it. They may not be competent, but it's still reaching millions of people every single day and ripping at the fabric of our society.
Well, and this is the thing that like is always the elephant in all of these rooms. The connective tissue here is Fox News. They carry the water. They carry the messaging. Even mentioning critical race theory, like the trajectory of where that story came from. This conservative filmmaker, Christopher Rufo, appeared on Fox News in early September of 2020. He said the words critical race theory. The White House was watching. They saw it. They liked it. Within a few days, they had Rufo at the White House to help them craft Donald Trump's executive order banning CRT in the federal government. That happened by the end of September. There's a direct through line to all of these stories and all of these conspiracies, and it is Fox News.
Yeah.
So before we go, obviously, this is still playing out because Trump held a rally this weekend, his first since leaving office. And what did he talk about? He talked about the big lie. Sam, let me start with you. What were your thoughts as this latest rally unfolded?
I would say to reporters covering it, just because everyone in those pins is full of great Vox, because they'll say crazy stuff for your article, doesn't mean it's an actual trend. I think we confuse sometimes the ease at which we can get a story to the importance of the story itself. It's really easy to do a story at a Trump rally. We know how to do it at this point, and there's a lot of folks that will give you great tape and great bites. It doesn't mean that it's the most important story in the country, and I don't think a Trump rally right now is nearly as important as journalists think it is.
Yeah. I agree with that. I do think, like, sort of having watched the whole thing, I do think it's instructive where you can see what they want to talk about, right? So ostensibly, 2022 is the focus. He leads with crime. He leads with murder. You know, defund the police, borders are overrun, cartels and drugs, right? Critical race theory, like those are their top core issues. But when you get to the end, after Trump complained about the teleprompters being messed up by the wind, you get into the parts that he really wants to talk about, which is just 30 more minutes regurgitating all the election lies. So I thought that was interesting and instructive, but you're right. It's not surprising. It's not new. It's just sort of like the core of the GOP message filtered through the broken brain of the president who would like to have won the election that he lost.
All right. Well, let's leave it there. When we come back, Republicans no longer love the troops. Last Wednesday, in a House Armed Services Committee hearing on the 2022 defense budget, Republicans pressed Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin to investigate the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and its use of critical race theory following reports that a guest lecturer at the academy used phrases such as white rage. Matt Gaetz took the opportunity to question the Military Academy's curriculum. Obviously, he's famous for funding a lot of tuition at various schools. He takes an interest in it. I'm very sorry. I know that this
Don't
year.
Be
I'm sorry.
Sorry for that.
All of this led to an impassioned response from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley. Let's listen.
On the issue of critical race theory, et cetera, I'll obviously have to get much smarter on whatever the theory is. But I do think it's important, actually, for those of us in uniform to be open-minded and be widely read. And the United States Military Academy is a university. And it is important that we train and we understand. And I want to understand white rage. And I'm white. And I want to understand it. So what is it that caused thousands of people to assault this building and try to overturn the Constitution of the United States of America? What caused that?
So Tucker Carlson reacted with his trademark subtlety.
He's not just a pig, he's stupid.
So Republicans lashed out against not just Milley, but the military in general. Gaetz said our nation's military should be focused on defending America, not defending wokeism. J.D. Vance, who is going to be running for Senate on these issues, he has basically said, I am going to run for Senate from Ohio on the culture wars, said, I personally would like American generals to read less about white rage, whatever that is, and more about not losing wars. John and Dan had a great conversation with Jelani Cobb a week or so ago about the propaganda campaign around critical race theory. But Sam, what was your reaction to Mark Milley's speech there?
I mean, honestly, when I saw it, I was like, go off, sis. Surprising. Wow. Okay. But I also think that, like, when you think about the military, particularly like the star generals and like top tier talent at the higher echelons of the military, they all see themselves as philosopher warrior kings. And they want to be highly educated and highly literate. And this is a tradition in the military that goes way far back. The second thing to keep in mind is that the American military on several issues has been a few steps ahead of the rest of American society on social issues. So the military racially integrated before the rest of the country did, decades ago. Before Donald Trump's trans ban in the military had thoroughly integrated trans employees into every layer of its workforce. And in fact, the U.S. military was the single largest employer of trans people in the country, if not the world. So if you know the history of the military, particularly the recent history of the military, the U.S. military, it's not out of line for someone like Mark Milley to say, we want to actually talk about race and study race. One, it is in line with this through line of intellectualism at the top ranks of the military. And two, the military's single goal is to get as many folks in as possible. And they need to have a space that feels welcoming to Black and brown people who disproportionately serve in the military. Right? And so further from that, to go to J.D. Vance's comments, he went on in this tweet storm to apparently say that the generals need to keep in mind that it's like poor white conservatives who disproportionately fight America's wars. That's not true. It's not true at all. It's never been true at all. Black and brown people and poor people disproportionately fight America's wars. And if you look at the highest rate of military service, that honor per capita goes to American Samoa, not a country full of white people. So there's a lot of mythology that you're seeing be poked in, holes being poked into some of the right-wing mythology about what the military actually is. It's not what you think it is.
Well, it's also they give away the game a bit when a general says, I want to understand what led to an insurrection. I want to understand racism in this society. And then a bunch of people raise their hands and say, how dare you?
Yeah.
Talk about me this way.
Yeah.
You know, how dare you attack people that see the world that way? Well, why are
you?
It's
the white rage that Milley speaks about. Yeah.
Right, right. So, Tommy, Michael Bender is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He has a report around Milley calling C+N a Monica fascist, Stephen Miller, that he told him to shut the fuck up because he was comparing Black Lives Matter protests in cities across the country to war zones. It does seem that part of the emotion in Milley's voice is rooted in genuine outrage about what took place in the insurrection and some of what he saw from inside the Trump administration. What did you make of his speech?
Yeah, I mean, I think Milley seems genuinely frustrated by what he had to deal with in the Trump days and also how he was portrayed because, you know, he was, you know, talked about in terms of the clearing of Lafayette Park and the Trump photo op. So, you know, I had a similar reaction to Sam. You know, it was like, good for General Milley. I mean, you know, as you noted, the military desegregated in 1948. That obviously didn't end the sort of systemic racism within the military. If you look at the top brass, it is overwhelmingly male, overwhelmingly white. But I also imagine Milley is aware that they have a real right-wing extremism problem in some parts of the military, right? Like the Oath Keepers, that was founded by an Army veteran. There were some ex-military members who were part of that mob that stormed the Capitol on January 6th. There's National Guard members have been removed from their posts for making extremist statements. So the Pentagon, they know this. They're aware of it. They're offering training to help sort of root out and identify some of this right-wing extremism. But to me, I mean, this is a story, once again, where like there is a lie that I think Sam sort of explained how it came to be extremely well, and all of a sudden it's on television, and then you wake up one day and 22 states have proposed laws to ban the teaching of historical racism, right? So like these lies have real world impact. And again, it shouldn't surprise us because culture war fights over curriculums or school textbooks are a constant in these new conservative politics. I was reading about how in 1974, some fundamentalist Christians were so angry about textbooks that they considered ungodly that they blew up a West Virginia school board building with dynamite.
And the great West Virginia textbook war. It was amazing. Yes. They were shooting up school buses. They had to close down the coal mines in that county in West Virginia because it got so crazy.
Yes. And you know who helped them out? The Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation sent a lawyer down to defend a bunch of domestic terrorists. So it should be no surprise to anyone that today the Heritage Foundation is releasing these hysterical reports about the dangers of critical race theory. So, you know, like Republicans look for these culture war issues. They want to exacerbate the feeling that like society is changing, that mostly white voters are losing their privileged place in society. That's what this is. And you can see with Tucker Carlson that his respect for reverence for the military comes after his reverence for white supremacy and, you know, his love of the culture wars. And that's what I made of just the whole, you know, J.D. Vance is an annoying troll who thinks that like he's just going to tweet his enough shit to get resistance liberals to, quote, tweet him in outrage and win a primary in Ohio. And he's a clown who's propped up by like Peter Thiel's, venture capital money as Vance denounces the tech industry. But yeah, I mean, like, I was not at all surprised by this. I think this is going to be their go-to.
You know, just to kind of piggyback on this idea that these culture wars have been with us for a very long time, they have. So on my show, I had a historian on who studies the history of education. We talked last Friday about critical race theory, and he outlined how this stuff goes back decades. Even in the 30s and 40s, you had the Daughters of the American Revolution and the American Legion fighting textbooks by some Columbia professor named Harold Rugg. And all he wanted these books to do was to have kids ask, what do you think about history and what should change, right? So this goes way back. And what's crazy about the origins of critical race theory, the guy that kind of made it a thing, Christopher Rufo, this investigative journalist filmmaker who went on Fox News last September and then made it a thing with the Trump White House, he has said in interviews, this is the same kind of stuff that we talk about when we decry multiculturalism or diversity, but the phrase critical race theory, it's nebulous enough to be scary. And I like that. Critical race theory as a term is not new. This is an academic term that was coined in like the 70s. And it's like a legal term to allude to policies and laws that might not directly address race, but can still be racist in their outcomes, given this nation's history. This is a graduate level theory for literally like law students. It's been around for a long time. It is just a nice new label for the same old fights. And it's nice for these folks because it's ambiguous enough to place all of your fears in it. And when you look at these interviews and these conversations where you ask folks about what's going to be taught or what's not going to be taught, they don't know what it is. They don't know what's in the books. It is just, it's just a symbol to launch their fears into. And I think that it all really boils down to race and who our public schools are for. You know, there are all kinds of issues that put school boards on edge about what can be in a textbook, right? Evolution, sex shit, gay shit. But the one that's always the worst, the one that always gets folks the most up in arms is race. And I think that it's because it gets to the core of what people think public education should be. There are some people that still believe that public schools and all schools exist primarily for white children and should indulge white fantasy to keep those white kids and their parents happy. But the rest of the country is quickly saying right now, we cannot continue to educate a diversifying country without actually speaking to the truth of what this country is, particularly for Black and brown children who are going to read that Pollyanna history and say, that don't make no sense. How, Sway? And so for me, it's not about the buzzword itself. It is not about, you know, one academic or one professor. It is about whether or not all of us in this country want to actually integrate our schools and not just integrate them by the makeup of the kids in them, but integrate the kind of ideas that we think our children can stomach. And it's got to be more than just white fantasy for white kids and their parents. It has to be.
Clint Smith's book has a really powerful chapter on this about, you know, the Lost Cause effort, which is an effort to rewrite the Civil War history, to defend the Confederacy, to make it as if it was about, you know, states' rights or something more noble than just the defense of slavery. He talks about how individuals who are pushing this Lost Cause ideology care about the monuments that people are tearing down, but they actually view children as the most powerful monuments because they can go on and spread that revisionist history lie, this Lost Cause narrative, to their friends, to their peers, and will defend it because it becomes something that gets ingrained in you. And no one likes to be told that what they think or believe or that their worldview is wrong. So you get, you know, attached to it almost.
Yeah. But in the absence of the truth about our history, you have these white parents who want to hold on to that white fantasy of what history was. And this idea that white people have always been the protagonist. That's really what it's at its core, right? This idea that white people were actually always on the good side all the time and they were the heroes. But when you do that, it says to every other child in that school, you don't just matter less, but the way you got to be here and the way that you and your community is, it doesn't make sense and we're not going to explain it to you. And so like it is it's not even like the fact that this conversation has been, we've been able to make this conversation about white kids and white parents. For me, they're a little bit less important than like the black and brown kids who are just going to grow up confused, totally confused. Mm-hmm. These white kids are going to be fine. These white kids have access to Google and TikTok and they're seeing this stuff anyway. These conversations happen anyway. I'm worried about the black and brown kids who are still told that the Civil War was about states' rights or who are never told the actual history of Native people in this country. Like their confusion is more important to me than these white parents' discomfort.
Sam, one more question on this. There's also this aspect in which this is a kind of role reversal where we've spent a lot of time having Republicans use the military as a cudgel against Democrats. And this seems like it's the reverse of that. What's your reaction to how that's been playing out?
I think it speaks to a larger issue of the way that the entire country conceptualizes the military, period. We see it as distinguished white men who are strong leaders like Milley, who talk that way and wear all the badges, when in actuality, a large swath of the military is black and brown, working class people, many of them women, many of them queer. I grew up in San Antonio, Texas. And when I was a kid, San Antonio had about 5 military bases just in the city. And the first, both high schools I went to were a few miles down the road from Randolph Air Force Base. And by virtue of my public school being next to an Air Force base, it was the most integrated school that I'd ever gone to in my life. It was about a third white, about a third black, about a third Hispanic. It was a totally integrated society. That was because of its proximity to the military. And so when I see these fights over Milley and what Milley means for the military, I think we have to expand the conversation and say the military was never just those white guys at the top. The military is an incredibly working class and in many cases, diverse institution. And when you hear from those voices, all of them holistically up and down the chain, Mark Milley's comments don't seem that out of place, right? We're looking like we have allowed ourselves to believe another white fantasy about what the military is. And it's never just that. It's never been just those white guys fighting our wars.
I also think that, like, you know, the Laura Ingrams of the world, the Tucker Carlsons, they know the power of that Milley speech, right? Like, they're communicators, they're partisans, they're propagandists. And you can look back in pretty recent history at comments made by Admiral Mike Mullen, a previous chairman of the Joint Chiefs, about the need to get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and the impact that those comments had on moving the debate forward and removing this horrendous rule or law or whatever it was, you know, getting rid of the stigma, right? And I think it was interesting and notable to me that Lloyd Austin, who is the Secretary of Defense, African-American, didn't necessarily seem like he felt like he had the same space to go on this soapbox the way Milley did. But frankly, like, we needed to hear it from Milley, right? Like, he is the sort of, you know, I think the kind of messenger who normally would convince a Fox News audience. And so they saw him as a threat and they went after him as hard as they could in the most personal terms. And they did it immediately.
It's the Elvis effect. You can have all these black singers sing their songs and they sound great. And it's not a hit until Elvis covers it. And it's just like, it happens in every space, in every way, all the time. And again, to take it back to my industry, we, capital J journalists, the media, have to fight that tendency to focus on the kind of voices that we think are from central casting. There's a lot of voices. Mm-hmm. There's always been a lot of voices.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. When we come back, we will briefly talk about a mini freakout over the infrastructure negotiations and cover a kind of intra Fox News fight that broke out over a surprising column.
Mm-hmm. In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
On Thursday, Joe Biden and the bipartisan group of lawmakers crafting an infrastructure deal announced that they had reached a $1.2 trillion deal focused on roads, bridges, tunnels, railways, waterways, and broadband to be paid for with increases in IRS enforcement projected to bring in a bunch of money in unpaid taxes. Biden's joy was short-lived. An hour later, during a news conference, the president told a reporter that he would not sign a bipartisan bill without the second reconciliation bill, a partisan Democratic-only bill that might spend trillions more. He said, if this is the only thing that comes to me, I'm not signing it. I'm not just signing the bipartisan bill and forgetting about the rest. Republicans responded with outrage. Senator Bill Cassidy said he felt blindsided. Senator Rob Portman was pissed and disappointed. Senator Susan Collins bemoaned the Republicans never had an inkling that there wouldn't be a linkage, which I found very Susian. This is despite the fact that everybody knew that this was what was going on.
Yeah.
These were linked publicly over and over again. Schumer said it on the floor. These two efforts are tied together. Let me make that clear. Speaker Pelosi agrees that we cannot do one without the other. Biden later walked back the comments saying that they were a mistake and affirming that he is standing by the bipartisan deal, saying, I fully stand behind it without reservation or hesitation. The New York Times had a play-by-play with this headline, how Biden's impromptu comments upended a political win, and this lead, it was all going according to President Biden's tightrope plan to pass the most ambitious economic agenda in generations, right until the moment that Mr. Biden, a politician with a history of rogue comments, veered off script. Tommy, this was pretty confusing because it seems like everyone knows what is going on, and Biden just said what was going on. But why is it so important that Biden not acknowledge the reality of the two bills being linked together?
I mean, I think what Biden was reflecting in his walk back is that the idea that he would veto the bipartisan bill if he didn't get the Democratic-only bigger bill could actually upset the negotiations. And so that's fine. And if they felt like they needed to do this dance to get things back on these two tracks, that's fine. I do, you know, sort of, I don't want to be a media critic here, but I think, you know, sort of echoing some of the things Sam said, like this is a lot of play acting and we're covering the play acting, right? I mean, you know, Mitch McConnell is just the most, his agenda is stopping Biden, right? He's just the most cynical person you could imagine. And so, of course, he's going to do everything he can to prevent this bill from passing, screw up bipartisan negotiations, prevent Democrats from doing a follow-on bill with a lot of additional liberal spending and maybe even a tax increase for the wealthiest people in the world. So he's going to throw whatever he can, whatever he can in the gears to try to muck this thing up. And it's a little bit frustrating that we are playing along, acting like these are real concerns, like anyone was surprised by this linkage when, as you said, everyone has talked about how Democrats are cool with the bipartisan bill because they know that they will get another run at it with their other priorities. It doesn't mean Manchin and Sinema are going to go along, but of course, everyone knew they were going to try. So, yeah, I mean, I read all these stories. I found them a little bit exhausting, but here we are.
I do think that there's this knee-jerk instinct to cover bipartisan negotiations from the point of view as Democrats, as the protagonists, trying to recruit the Republicans as the antagonists, which ends up being about, like, what are we doing to keep the Republicans on board? What are the Democrats doing to keep the Republicans in line? But actually, this doesn't seem to be about the Republicans. I mean, I understand why, for pure kind of messaging, the Republicans want to not have them be linked directly, because it's a little bit like, wait a second, so we're going to do what we both agree to together, and then when we go to the bathroom, you're going to do all the stuff we hate. Like, I get there's a little bit of a kind of strangeness to that. But really, this seems less about those 10 Republicans who are going along with this because they know Democrats can pass a reconciliation bill without them with all this stuff. So it's just about them getting credit for some piece of this. It's about keeping the 50 Democrats together. And it seems like you keep the 50 Democrats together, you need to show a couple of those Democrats that you're willing to do this bipartisan deal. Like, Sam, is that right? Is that how you're seeing this?
I don't know. I read all the stuff about it and was trying to get right into this whole story before taping. And the only big thought that I came away with was, oh, Joe Biden made a gaffe? So surprising. He's never done that before. I mean, this just seems like a whole lot of crying over like the normal order of things.
Totally.
When bills this big work their way through both chambers, this is kind of how it's done. This is the order of things. And this is the way that Joe Biden does politics. He just talks and he never shuts up unless you make him shut up. And I think ultimately, at the end of the day, something passes. Because one thing I know for sure, in spite of all the hemming and hawing over the cost of infrastructure and the cost of this and that, something all politicians in Congress love to do is go home to their districts and talk about all the money they got for their district, they got for their county, they got for their state in the latest bill that just passed.
Yep.
Whatever these folks say about the cost of these bills, they all like to go home and brag about getting money for their home. They do. And I just really think that at a certain point, something passes, something big. These kind of conversations will keep happening. You know, see the forest. You know, this is one tree in a forest, is one tree. Keep that in mind.
Yeah. Also, you know, Sam, that point is so true that you had Republicans bragging about money going to their districts from a COVID relief bill that they voted against. So, yes, maximum cynicism here. I mean, I also think the more interesting to me, Lovett, was I saw AOC came out over the weekend on the Sunday shows, and she's like, look, my message to Biden is House progressives wanting to succeed. We want to pass this bigger infrastructure bill. So that gave me some hope. You saw Manchin talking about how, you know, he's willing to sort of meet in the middle, maybe not a $6 trillion bill, but maybe not a $1 trillion bill. He's talking about raising taxes on some of the richest people in the country to potentially pay for it. So all of that made me hopeful. There is, though, like, there's that. That's like the political piece of my brain. The sort of human being who lives in the world in 2021 part of my brain is sitting around looking at news reports of like Seattle being 115 degrees and like 110 in Canada and thinking like, holy shit, I hope we do the climate change money ASAP because things are real bad and that should be our priority.
Yeah, no, but it does seem like there is a larger lesson here in that, you know, one thing that's been so frustrating about Manchin and Sinema, and we're not going to talk about them again today, is that, okay, they're not for getting rid of the filibuster. We get it. We've read both of your op-eds. But the they could have kept the filibuster in place while threatening to get rid of it, which would have put them in a position to negotiate better bipartisan deals. And one of the lessons for why this bipartisan deal is even on the table is because those Republicans know there's a partisan deal that will happen with or without them, that like the threat of legislating without the Republicans have put the Republicans in a position of wanting to negotiate. And there's a lesson there if Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema care to learn it, but unfortunately, they are not interested in lessons. Before we go, last week in the Times, Ben Smith reported what many reporters have apparently known, that Tucker Carlson spends his time when he's not denouncing the liberal media by trading gossip with them. He's the go-to guy for sometimes unflattering stories about Donald Trump and for coverage of the internal politics of Fox News. This led to a ton of internecine, horrible, horrible fighting amongst some of the worst human beings on planet Earth. And so, because this is pointless navel-gazing, and therefore we are going to indulge in it briefly, here's how this works. I'm going to read a quote, and you're going to have to tell us who said it, all right? Call it out if you know it. Tommy and Sam, call it out if you know
it. Okay.
This is eerily similar to a game called Who Said That? That Sam plays on It's Been a Minute. Here we go. Now, the big news is that some people at Fox apparently don't like me and said bad things about me, gutlessly, behind my back, according to Ben Smith and members of the media mob. Ben, if that's true, that's called a normal day in the world that I live in. Who said it?
Tucker Carlson?
Sam, who's... No. Tommy?
Black belt in karate, Sean Hannity?
That is correct. Next quote. I don't give an Adam Schiff about what anybody says about me.
Tucker Carlson. No.
Mm-mm.
Oh, man.
Laura Ingraham?
It was Sean Hannity. Final quote, okay. I'm not going to change just because some of you don't like me.
Tucker Carlson. Just one.
Nope.
Sean,
nope.
Sean again? Sean Hannity?
It was Sean Hannity. He went on a very, very long diatribe about Tucker Carlson, and it's a delight, and every piece of it is enjoyable. But
WandaVision voice, it was Sean Hannity all along. Wow.
It was Sean Hannity all along.
Well, all you can do is have fun with this story because these people are just so full of shit that it's fun to lay it all bare the way Ben Smith did. It does make me think back about years and years of what felt like soft coverage of Tucker Carlson, of reticence to refer to his content as sort of white supremacist, even when it clearly was, right? When he's talking about like South African white farmers being killed, like literally like pulled off the V-Dare, like sort of white supremacist websites. And now you have to wonder, is that because the people who cover him and are supposed to write these things up are more concerned about losing him as a source? I saw Astead Wesley from the New York Times sort of tweet something to this effect that was just sort of like, this is a reminder of some of the circles you are expected to run in to get all the big scoops and why it's real shitty sometimes in Washington. I thought that was instructive.
I mean, they're all such messy queens. I mean, it's like, come on. When you see this like sniping back and forth from people who work together,
yeah,
you're just like, grow up. Like, at least like help try to protect the company bottom line. Like, I got a lot of colleagues I can't stand. You're not going to hear about it on my show. You know, it's not going to be on my show.
Yeah. Open up Slack. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And another thing about Ari Shapiro, that guy grows pears inside of a jar. What's he trying to prove? Who's got time to plan? That's real, by the way. He does grow pears inside of a jar, and it's always bothered me.
He lives in a perfect farmer's market.
I tell him to his face.
Yeah. I crashed at Ari Shapiro's house, this is years ago, for like a week. And every day, I'd come in there and he would have made me a meal like from the garden. And after he worked a full damn day, like, now that guy, let him run Fox News, NPR, all of them. Put him in
charge.
And
he can sing?
Yeah.
He's in a band that plays at like Carnegie Hall. I mean,
and he's tall. And
people should be looking into this.
Tall.
Yeah, he's in good shape. Nobody's talking about this. Why aren't they taking it to Ari?
We're not doing a good job leaking about Ari Shapiro. They're not supposed to be compliments.
Well, I heard.
It is also, I think, like Tucker Carlson is putting on a show. He's playing a character. And all the people he's texting know that it's a character. All the people in Tucker's life that apologize around him, all the people that work for, everybody thinks it's just a...
He's the Colbert Report.
But it's not a game. Yeah. But it's not a game because people take it really seriously and it's really dangerous, so... With that, that's our show. Sam Sanders, thank you so much for being here. That was so much fun.
It's great to be here.
Dan will be back on Thursday with Anant Shankar Osorio, and very excited about that conversation. Have a great week, everybody.
Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our senior producer is Flavia Casas. Our associate producers are Jazzy Marine and Olivia Martinez. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to Tanya Sominator, Katie Long, Roman Papadimitrio, Caroline Rustin, and Justine Howe for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, Milo Kim, Yale Freed, and Nar Melkonian, who film and share our episodes as videos every week.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts, and on YouTube.